Live from the Ghost Hunter Store. Brought to you by the Shadowlands, South Jersey Ghost Research, and the Ghost Hunter Store. Here's some paranormal straight talk with your hosts, Dave Giuliano and Marty Haynes.
Hi everybody and welcome to the show. Tonight's going to be a little bit different format. It's going to be more like a classroom format for those of you who have asked to attend some of the classes that we give here at the store or some of the events where South Jersey Ghost Research teaches some of how to use some of the equipment or even just off the Shadowlands and the Ghost Hunting 101 page. I'm going to combine all of them together and try to give you a brief overview on how to use some of the basic equipment of ghost hunting and use it properly. Now, tonight we're not coming live from the Ghost Hunter Store. Matter of fact, I'm not even in New Jersey at all. I am in the Outer Banks in North Carolina right now while I'm recording this, and it is pre-recorded. Marty is in New Jersey at the Ghost Hunter Store, so if you feel free to stop in and say hi there. That leads us right back into what we were doing here tonight. And for those of you who are far away and can't attend any of these kind of classes or events, I'm going to try to go through the class exactly as I would, basically going over the basic equipment structure. And like I said, depending on where you've learned it from, whether you've learned it from watching TV or learned it from another group or from a book, these are the methods and the techniques that I use. This is the information that I've learned. So that if there's any discrepancies, you know, feel free to shoot us an email. You know, I'm always learning new things, as everyone should be in this field. And hopefully you'll keep that open mind too when some of you realize that you may be actually using some of this equipment the wrong way, and some of the people you may see out there on shows or have seen in person at events are also using the equipment the wrong way. So what we're going to start with is your basic piece of equipment that people associate the most with ghost hunters. That would be the EMF meter. It's an electromagnetic field meter. Now, what they read is the magnetic portion of the electromagnetic field if you are using one of the main meters that you see everyone using. If your meter is reading in milligauss, which is the unit of measure for electromagnetic field detectors reading the magnetic portion of the field, most meters that you see people using are gauss meters. The reason why we look for the magnetic portion of the field as opposed to the electric portion of the field is that the magnetic portion goes way further out beyond where the electric field is. So that means that you're going to be able to pick up on and detect the electromagnetic field well before you would using the magnetic reading of a gauss meter as opposed to the electric reading. Now, there are meters out there that read in nanotesla, and they will read the electric portion. And those of you who have the tri-field meters, you know that they also have settings on there that read magnetic or electric. Basically, with the exception of one meter, the tri-field natural meter, we use all the meters set on magnetic if it has a choice, simply because you're going to detect something sooner. Now, what exactly are we looking for with the meters to begin with before we really delve into how all they operate? A magnetic or electromagnetic field has to have a source of some kind. It's some sort of power supply or a motor, you know, a light ballast. Something is giving off that field. It's a generating that field. Without a source, you shouldn't find an electromagnetic field. You won't find a free-floating electromagnetic field that does not have a source that will suddenly appear and disappear. That's not supposed to happen. Yet that is exactly what we're looking for when we're using EMF meters on investigations. And we do find these anomalous EMF readings on investigations in places that are reporting haunting or spirit activity. That is the basic use of an EMF meter. It's not to detect ghosts. How spirits relate to electromagnetic fields? There are just theories. None of us really know exactly how they relate. So when someone says, hey, you know, I have an EMF meter, I'm going to be able to find ghosts. Yeah, it's not entirely true. I personally have been in front of apparitions that I've seen with my eyes 3-4 feet away and been holding an EMF meter at the same time and have gotten no reading whatsoever. So I don't think that spirits actually, you know, are the source of the electromagnetic fields, but maybe before they arrive or an after effect, or maybe they're attracted to this anomalous energy to begin with. Who knows? But at least you should know why we're using it and how it works. Now, there's a wide variety of models out there. Should you have just one? If that's what your budget allows, then hey, that's all you can afford. But as you go on for this, and the more you delve into this field, you'll find that, just like a mechanic, having more than one type of tool is very helpful. So I'm going to go run down the list of some of the more common ones that you will see used by investigators out in the field. The first one is the ELF zone. I think everyone is kind of familiar with this one. This is the little white one made by Enzone Corporation, who no longer exists. They're still imported from China, and when that supply runs out, that'll be it. They're probably most well known for the fact that they are the cheapest EMF meter you can find out there. They range anywhere from $20 down to $10. The benefit of these meters is that they have relatively good shielding compared to some of the other meters. So while they will pick up interference from, you know, say electrical cables or a refrigerator or a ceiling fan getting too close, you are not going to pick up radio waves and other things that may interfere with other meters. Now, the beauty of this is it's foolproof in its setup. You have three lights. You have a safe light, which is basically the light that comes on with the power, and you have a caution light and a danger light. The caution light lights up yellow in the middle, and it's exactly the area that we're looking for when we're looking for anomalous EMF readings. 2 to 7 milligauss. Why do we start at 2? There's a lot of people out there that, and I just, you know, skipping channels, saw this happen on a show last week where someone was getting excited about seeing a 0.8 on one of their digital EMF meters. And a 0.8 means absolutely nothing, because you have to take into account some of these meters and the possible sensitivity that they could be picking up the Earth's magnetic field, because they are Gauss meters and are going to read magnetic fields. Now, the Earth's magnetic field is constantly in flux, but it's somewhere between 1 and 2 milligauss. So you really don't want to be detecting anything below 1 or 2 milligauss. Definitely nothing below, you know, in the 0.1 range. That's insignificant altogether. So anything from 2 on up, and we're looking for stuff that cuts it out or cut somewhere in the range where other things might cut in, like your monitor or, let's say, a ballast from a fluorescent light might start around 8 or 9. So we're looking for a very small window, and we're looking for it to suddenly appear and disappear in an area where you cannot get it again. That is the key. So what the ELF zone does is basically you're looking for a yellow light to light up. If you see that yellow light lighting up, you know, that's great. You now have something that's generating an electromagnetic field. What you should do if it stays lit is start walking in a direction and see if you can find out where the natural source is. It's okay if your meters pick up natural sources, because you want to be able to map them out and rule them out. You also want to be aware that high levels of electromagnetic fields can cause electromagnetic field poisoning, or whether it's tied to that or it's just the effects of the electromagnetic field itself at high levels can cause hallucinations and feelings of, say, being watched, impressions that you may be seeing or hearing something. So it's a lot of stuff that sounds exactly like people report in houses. So there are cases that you will encounter or may encounter that it's as simple as changing out a faulty ground wire and electrical box, which is exactly just what happened to us. The one up the whole house was hot. there was no grounding, so there was a hot electromagnetic field through the whole house. And when we approached different areas of the house closer to the where the grounding wire was, it actually maxed out our digital recorders. It was well above 2,000 milligauss, which obviously is going to be causing people to have issues identical to what the people reported in the house, which were seeing things, hearing things, feeling like they were being watched. It was your typical case where it was the EMF doing it, not anything spiritual. They had an electrician come out, and so far there hasn't been any reports of any activity whatsoever. So it looks like that's case solved. You know, that might be a disappointment to some of you, but that's the one case that you've been looking forward to, and you don't have many on your schedule, but hey, you've helped that person. That's all that counts. You've helped them with a serious situation. It just turned out to not be paranormal in this case, and that's okay. I'm gonna go down to the next model on my list anyway. These are not in any kind of order where I'm saying preference or whether one's better than the other. There are a few that I recommend for people, beginners and, you know, higher level, or people who are more, you know, get more use out of their professionals. This meter, the Osun EMF meter, it's called the EMF Hunter. I like this one. Again, this is another one that's easy to use in the dark. It has a dedicated on-off switch. It has a digital readout from 1 to 10 in colored LEDs. So it's a no-brainer. You can see exactly what you're reading in the dark. You know exactly the milligauss reading you get. And once you get above 7 or 8 to the higher readings where you probably have a natural source, it actually gives off an audible alarm. So that's wonderful when you're doing this stuff, if someone's going to tip you off and let you know that, hey, there's something going on here. That may not be paranormal. The next meter on our list is the electrosensor, electromagnetic field detector. This is a nice little pocket-sized meter. Gives you a red digital LED readout. The numbers don't run consecutively. It skips around once you get past 5. It jumps up to 8 and 11. But this is still a good meter. Now, this is a good meter to explain why and the range of some meters and why that's important. This meter has a range of about 3 foot in front of it, which means that, you know, past 3 feet, you're not going to detect anything. You're going to need to be on top of the electromagnetic field source if you are going to be able to detect it with this meter. Now, another thing you should be aware of with all meters, what you want to picture is the area that it covers. In order for you to picture this, picture the front of the meter or the probe in the case of the cell sensor. When you point that in that direction, picture a flashlight beam, how it starts out small around the bulb and the lens and then gets wider as it goes out, like in a cone shape. If you picture that flashlight beam coming out of the front of your EMF meter, that imaginary cone is the area that the EMF meter is detecting any kind of fluctuations or anomalies in. So you want to be aware of that. You want to be aware that when you get a reading, it's in front of you and maybe out as far as 10 to 12 feet, depending on the meter, so that when you tell people you're getting a reading, you can kind of point them in the general direction so no one's taking pictures in the wrong place to begin with. But back to the electrosensor, since this is 3 feet, you do want to be aware of that. Skip back to the other two, the ELF zone and the EMF hunter. The normal range is about 10 to 12 feet, roughly, for most EMF meters, and that's the same with them. So anywhere in a cone shape getting wider going out, as the further it gets away, about approximately 10 to 12 feet for most meters, you're going to be able to detect that. So keep in mind when you're placing stationary meters around too, that you're not overlapping and being redundant with your placement, that you're getting the most out of what you have and the most coverage area you can by taking advantage of how far some of these meters will read stuff at. The next meter on my list is something of an enigma to many ghost researchers out there. This is probably the most misused piece of equipment out there. It is the Tri-Field Natural EM meter. Now, Tri-Field does make an EMF meter. That's the basic Tri-Field meter. That meter, you have a setting of magnetic and electric on it, and depending on what you set it at, you will have either the magnetic portion or the electric portion being detected. Now, the regular Tri-Field It's basically a needle on a screen, so you can't really see it in the dark as well. This is a drawback for some of the people, but it is a very sensitive piece of equipment. It's one of the more expensive pieces of equipment that people will buy, and it's definitely more in the scientific range, but it's still a good meter. You just have to be aware that maybe that's something you're going to put a video camera on or have someone watch it with a flashlight, whatever you want to do. You don't have the luxury of a digital readout that's backlit. Now, back to the Tri-Field Natural EM meter. This is the one with the blue label on it, and it has a variety of different settings, including a radio and microwave setting, but the one that's the most useful to me is the one that's between magnetic and electric, which is SUM. Now, when you set this meter on SUM, you are reading the magnetic and electric portion of the EMF field, and you can also detect some static charges too. So you're getting an added bonus by setting it on SUM. Now, if you picture the cone shape coming out of the front of this meter can read up to about 25 feet away. It is very, very sensitive to vibration, so walking by it may set this meter off. It also has an audible alarm. Now, the knob on the side that most people feel is a volume knob is not a volume knob at all. What it does is it regulates where the sound turns on and where the sound turns off. And what I like to set it at is so the audible alarm will start turning on above 2, on when the needle hits above 2, and shut off when it goes below 2. And then again, it's back to the magnetic field of the Earth. We're not interested in reading that, so we want to disregard everything that's under 2. Also, this meter is sensitive enough to pick up the electrical charge in human bodies. It is also sensitive enough to pick up thunderstorms up to 3 miles away. So keep that in mind when you're looking at the weather forecast for the night. That is something you should be doing, because some pieces of equipment might not work properly, and this is a perfect example of that. But why this meter... it is technically, I guess, fits into an EMF meter category, but it does something completely different out of the way normal meters read. What this meter does when you turn it on is it zeroes itself out like a scale, which means it takes into account everything that's in its coverage range, accounts for it, and settles back down to zero. So now if anything changes in that area that it's covering, it will then give off a signal and give an intensity alarm. The higher the needle goes, the higher pitched the audible alarm is. Now, it's almost like a trap setting for any kind of energy that comes into that room, whether it's magnetic, electric, or static. It really doesn't matter, because what you're interested in most is that this thing zeroed out the room. It accounted for everything that was in there. So something in the room now has changed. And because the meter works this way, regardless of what you've seen on TV and regardless of what you've been taught or what you've read, this meter cannot be walked around with. Not to mention the vibration factor alone, that will be enough to set this off. If you walk around with this, it will constantly give you an audible alarm, and you will think that you are following a spirit around or chasing something around, when that's not the case at all. What you're doing is you're causing it to reset itself and try to zero itself out constantly by moving. So because you're moving it, it's going to constantly keep going back up above 2 or whatever you have it set on, and constantly giving you readings. And they're just false readings due to the movement and its inability to zero out. So, you know, please keep that in mind when you see people using that. You know, you might want to pull them aside and say, hey, this is not how the meter works. I know the instructions are very hard to read. They're very, very, you know, over the top and very, very scientific minded, but... this is the way the meter works. So it can be a great meter, it can be a great tool. I personally carry one on every investigation, and SJGR we have in our equipment kits. There's at least 3 for each team that goes out, so we can cover at least have one on almost every floor that we're on, because it's that valuable of a tool. Because you know when you hear that alarm going off that something has significantly changed in the room. I think I've harped on that enough. Let's go to some of the other ones that people see a lot of, which are the two twins, the ghost meter and the cell sensor. Both of them have an audible alarm and a visual light that lights up too. They're both great for walking around with, and they're both great for stationary use too. Because with the audible alarm and the light, particularly the audible alarm, you do not have to be watching it when it's going to detect something. So if you put it in a stationary position, you can turn your back, you can walk out of the room. You'll hear that alarm going off and you'll know that it just detected something. And when it's stationary, that means something moved into the coverage area. So there shouldn't be any moving electromagnetic fields unless someone's wheeling a motor by or someone just, you know, moved some sort of object that's generating electricity or a field in its path, which is probably unlikely on an investigation. So you set these up kind of like electromagnetic field motion sensors. Gives you an ability to cover more areas for a relatively inexpensive price. Now these are, you know, analog, which means they just have the needle on the screen that you're going to read. But again, you're not going to be as concerned with the exact reading. You're going to be concerned if you're using it stationary that you suddenly got a reading to begin with in an area that you shouldn't have any kind of electromagnetic fields moving through. Now the difference between the two, besides about a $2 to $5 price difference, and one has a translucent case, and is the probe. The cell sensor comes with a little probe, and some people find that annoying and they'll go for the ghost meter. But for an upgrade of, you know, like I said, maybe a few bucks, the cell sensor with that probe on a 4-foot wire gives you something a little extra that you don't get. You get the ability to dangle that probe, which is now the front of the meter, down stairwells, tie it off onto banisters, get weird angles, say you need a 45 degree angle pointing up a staircase. That's kind of hard unless you have some props with you to sit the EMF meter on to point up on that angle. But with the cell sensor and the probe, you can just tie it off to a banister, you know, Velcro it onto something. Rooms that we had didn't have access to all the areas. Maybe it was a locked door. We were able to, you know, put the probe underneath the locked door, and so we're at least reading into that area. There's so many different variety of things you can do. Even like when I'm outside a lot in the cemeteries, I'll put the main unit in my pocket, and I'll carry the probe and I'll strap it like underneath my watch band. So basically my hand is like a moving wand detecting electromagnetic fields. And if it suddenly picks something up, I'm going to hear that alarm even coming from my, you know, my jacket pocket. So don't discount the meter just because this probe seems to be like an annoying attachment that you might not get a lot of use out of. I personally would prefer the cell sensor because of that ability. But like I said, both of them work great as a standalone like electromagnetic field trap. Now I know there's a lot of different types of meters out there, and I'm going to skip over a lot of different ones. So if you have any questions about a particular model, you'll feel free to shoot us an email. You can reach me or Marty at South Jersey Ghost Research at hauntedhelp.org. You can reach us at the store, whether you call or you go to the ghosthunterstore.com. Or you can reach me at the Shadowlands, theshadowlands.net. So any of those places you can get a hold of us and ask us if you have any more questions or want us to cover or let you know how a certain meter works. I guess I should talk next about the K2 meter. Many of us saw this, I guess, for the first time or on Ghost Hunters. It was featured with Chris Fleming getting it to spirits to manipulate it so they get a response back and forth. The meter actually dates way back, much further back than that, but it wasn't really a popular meter until that kind of gave it the little spur for people to realize that, hey, there's another meter out here. Now, I personally don't use it to elicit contact from spirits simply because there is a known flaw in with the K2 and its shielding. It actually picks up, or has the potential to pick up, outside signals such as radio waves or anything from like radio transmission towers to when your cell phone's pinging the local tower. Anything like that could cause a false positive. So if you factor any of that in with any of the conversations that you may be having, that some of those lights in response to an answer might not be a response, that might be your cell phone or something else causing it, then you have to, you know, eliminate the whole conversation if that kind of takes everything out of context. So just keep that in mind when you're using the K2 meter. You want to be aware that if you're going to have any kind of interference from any stuff, you may want to shut your cell phones off and not use the FRS radios. The walkie-talkies, they may interfere too when they key up. So you just want to be very cautious when you're using the K2 because of that issue. Hopefully, K2 will, the manufacturer is aware of that from what I understand. And hopefully, they will address that issue and shield the meter a little bit better, and that would eliminate that. And then everything people are doing with the K2 now would at least be able to have be more valid without that, I guess, that black cloud hanging over it of potential contamination because of the outside interference. And the next meter I want to talk about before I close out, like the how the EMF meters work, is the MEL 8704 meter. Now, there's a variety of different, you know, models off. There's the MEL K2 Hybrid, the MEL RAM, the MEL Vibe, the MEL Navigator. Basically, the basic model reads ambient temperature. It reads EMFs, and it also has a flashlight built in the front. That's your basic model. It's red backlit screen, so it's perfect. It doesn't mess up your night vision at all. And if this sounds like, wow, this is like great, who thought of this? Well, it's made by DAS, and they're, when this was designed, I guess was being contemplated, they talked to a lot of different people in the field and got their opinions on what they'd like to see in a meter. This is the only, or I should say now, the first piece of equipment that we use that was designed specifically for paranormal research. Right in front of you, at your fingertips, in the dark, you have access to a very, very precise electromagnetic field reading, a very, very precise ambient temperature reading, and a flashlight if you need it. All that you can see in the dark, you can. It has many other features, like you can turn the backlight off, you can record your highest readings, you can change the range, you can even switch it over to reading the electric portion of the field if you want. It's simply, hands down, probably the best meter out there because it was made specifically for paranormal research, so it's more of a custom fit. Now, with that said, I use that, and I still use a cell sensor, and I still use almost, I have every one of the meters that I've already talked about tonight in my case, so there's a place for all of them. It's just, you know, most of us are, you know, working on a budget, so I didn't have them all in my case when I first started. You know, I started that with the ELF Zone as my very first meter. So, you know, you have to pace yourself. Don't expect to get a full case right away. But it's good to know that you can have a variety of the same piece of equipment, because all these meters do something a little bit different than the other ones. And with the MEL meter, there's no audible alarm. So because of the backlit screen, you can easily see it as you're walking around. So it's a meter that you can use to walk around. It's not very, you don't want to shake it violently, but the simple walking and vibration like that is not going to set it off and give it false readings. So it's a perfect meter to walk around with while, say, the, you know, while you have your cell sensor stationed other places and posted other places, pointing other areas that you're not necessarily at, and you'll hear them if they go off. So it gives you the ability to be mobile while you're still covering a lot of areas, just with maybe, you know, two or three different meters. The next category of equipment we are going to discuss is temperature reading equipment, thermometers. Now, there's two kinds of temperature that we are interested in. Although many people discount one, I believe it's because they don't understand simply how it works and how important the readings could be. That would be the surface temperature readings of a non-contact infrared thermometer. But first, let's go back to the ambient temperature. Ambient temperature is the temperature that we feel all around us, that is right around the thermometer itself. Like the MEL meter or any regular indoor-outdoor thermometer or any kind of basic thermometer in a home, these are all reading the ambient ambient temperature around the bulb of the thermometer. Now, when people feel cold spots or feel certain areas that are really cold, this might be the because you actually want to feel the air temperature here. This is the kind of thermometer that you would use. You have to physically put the thermometer or the bulb of the thermometer. Sometimes the bulb is on a long 12-foot probe for an indoor-outdoor thermometer. You actually have to put the bulb or the thermometer base itself in the cold spot at the time it's happening. So that means you need something that's very reacts very quickly to temperature changes. Most over-the-counter thermometers do not. You need something a little more specialized that's going to give you a faster temperature reading, because if it's a real quick change where someone feels cold for just a few moments, unless you have something that reacts quickly to the temperature drop or the temperature increase, you're not going to be able to detect that with a regular thermometer. So just keep that in mind when you're shopping for ambient thermometers. Anything that uses a thermocouple probe, like the front of the Melmeter, the little wire sticking out, a K-probe, anything that uses something like that is going to normally be a lot faster than your just generic household thermometer. You're going to get very quick changes, so something like that's good to use. Or some specialized thermometers that are made to react quickly to ambient air temperature changes. Now, the other kind of thermometer that a lot of people don't use, again, like I said, I think it's people discount it. And this is from just sitting there listening to people come to the store, and you know, they're talking about different things, and someone will pick one up and say, no, we don't need to use that because that just reads surface temperature. Is the non-contact infrared thermometer. It's still a great piece of equipment. And the reason it is because it reads surface temperature. Now, this is the part that a lot of people, when I run my trainees through the training course that SJGR gives, they get a problem with this and some other pieces of equipment, because it's, again, it's a little more scientific. You kind of have to know how something works and remember it. But it's good for you to know that, because one day a client of yours, you know, someone you're investigating their house for, is going to ask you how something works, and you should have the right answer for them, because if you don't, anything you find in reference to spirits is going to be lack credibility simply because you weren't aware exactly of how the equipment that you were using worked. So, you know, keep that in mind. It's good for everybody to know exactly what they're using and how it works. Back to the infrared non-contact thermometers. Regardless of whether they shoot out a laser beam, they do not send anything out. The laser beam actually is annoying and dangerous and messes with the focus on a lot of cameras. So if you have the ability to turn the laser pointer off, do so, because it's not necessary. That's not doing anything. It's a laser sight. So a mechanic can know exactly what part he's pointing it at that he's going to be reading the temperature of. That's all it is. It's a laser sight. So you don't need it for ghost hunting. But like I said, they don't send anything out. Picture that same cone-shaped area we were talking about with the electromagnetic fields. Picture that going out from the front of the thermometer. That's the area that it's covering. It's reading in things. And what it's reading in is the infrared heat signature off of objects in that field. Now, everything above absolute zero gives off an infrared heat signature. Everything. So the wall is giving off an infrared heat signature. We give off an infrared heat signature. And this is where it becomes important. If you're pointing an infrared non-contact thermometer at a wall and you're reading 78 degrees, first of all, you're probably reading close to what the ambient temperature is anyway, within a degree or two, providing there's no pipes in that wall or there's no poor insulation or a window or anything like that. But in a basic, say, solid wall, indoor wall of the house, it's probably going to be close to ambient anyway. So we're reading 78 degrees. All of a sudden, it drops down to, say, you know, 50 or 40 degrees. You just got a very significant temperature drop. Yeah, you know, we're kind of interested in temperature changes of 10 degrees or more, roughly, as like a rule of thumb. So you just got a very significant temperature drop, dropping from 78 down to, say, 40 degrees, 38-degree temperature drop. What could cause that? Well, it's a surface reading thermometer. So that means it's reading a surface that's now suddenly between you and the wall. And if you can't see anything, that means something that's giving off an infrared heat signature of that low of a temperature is now between you and the wall. There shouldn't be any invisible objects giving off a differing infrared heat signature that you can't see. It's just, I mean, that almost could be part of a description of a ghost. If you want something it's solid in the infrared sense, but we can't, not visible to the naked eye. So it's very significant, and it's very useful. And the people that use passive infrared motion sensors, or like the hunting cams or any kind of infrared motion sensing device that may have a camera involved,
this thermometer is working the exact same technology. So if you use that and then discount using an infrared thermometer, then you're not understanding how the whole thing works or how either item actually works. All the motion sensor does is chime, or if it's a hunting camera, it takes a picture whenever it detects the infrared heat signature that suddenly changes in its area that it's covering. What the thermometer does is just give you a temperature readout instead of what that temperature change is. So they work identical. To me, if I'm suddenly, and I've been in that position where I've been on an investigation pointing the thermometer around the room, that you can see the temperature changes really quickly, so it's not something you have to hold and pinpoint one spot. You can move it quickly around through the air and try to cover a whole room in a matter of seconds. Yeah, I've been pointing it at a staircase that was reading ambient air temperature that suddenly dropped down 20 degrees colder for about 2 seconds, then went back up. And I was unable to find, going back over the area with the thermometer, anything that would cause another similar drop like that. So there was no natural cause. A cold draft coming in, anything like that, this is reading surface temperature. It's not reading air temperature. So that will not affect it at all. It has to be some surface change, like say a pipe in a wall or something like that, or a window crack or a different material that's holding in or releasing heat more. So if you're pointing at something and you get that temperature drop, something dramatic has just happened. There's something in front of you that is now different, and something that something is also solid in the infrared sense. That's why you see a lot of us use a lot of the infrared equipment, the infrared cameras, the infrared motion sensors, the infrared thermometers. There's something in that infrared signal or that infrared light range that we're definitely picking up on. They're the basic two kind of things you would be using in the temperature sense. And, I'm assuming that everyone can read temperature. The same thing with EMF meters. As long as you can count to at least 7, you're good. None of this stuff is really rocket science. It's simple to use as long as you know how each device works and the theories behind it. That's all. And it doesn't take a lot to learn that. But there's a lot of people that take shortcuts or just maybe were just trained wrong from the beginning and just kept going and never bothered to follow up on things themselves to see that this doesn't sound right, or maybe I should just double check to see how things work, because I found I was using something wrong before. And it happens to everybody. These tools, or most of them, aren't really designed for this field that we're in. They're designed for other applications, so you're going to run into things every once in a while that are being used, we're using them in a different way, so we kind of need to know exactly how they originally work to begin with, and then how we apply them to ghost hunting. You kind of need to know both in order to, come off with that sense that you really know what you're doing. Because there's, especially nowadays with the TV shows, that people are more aware of what we do. They go to conferences, they read magazines. There's a chance that someone at an event somewhere is going to ask you a question that they already know the answer to. They may ask you how an infrared non-contact thermometer works, waiting to see what you say. And as soon as you say it sends out a beam and reads something, right away they know that you simply don't know how that piece of equipment works. And since it's a basic piece of equipment for ghost hunting, that's how they're going to judge your whole realm of knowledge. And do you really want to be judged on something when you may have a lot of experience in other aspects of it? So it's good for everybody to know this. Even, like I said, my trainees for my group, whether they're going to wind up doing more of the psychic aspect of it or maybe more of just videotaping, we never know what the person's going to want to choose to do or what their forte will be. But we train them all to know the basic stuff so that should someone ask, they do know how to use it, and they can explain to someone how it works in a situation where maybe someone else won't be able to answer them right away, or if they're put on the spot. So it's definitely a good thing for all your investigators to know exactly how an item works. Now, I've just kind of covered the how the motion sensors work. As long as it's a passive infrared motion sensor, whether it's just a motion sensor chime or whether it's attached to a mini DVR or a hunting cam with infrared flash bulbs, it all works the same. It's set up viewing a coverage area. If something now changes in that coverage area with a different infrared heat signature or a new infrared heat signature being introduced, and whether it chimes or takes a picture or whatever, it's telling you that there was a change in that area that's covering. Now, if you set up just a chime motion sensor down a hallway and suddenly it chimes, that means something with an infrared heat signature that wasn't there before is now there. And most of the cheaper ones that we use are really calibrated, so they're going to pick up something maybe 4 or 5 pounds and higher. So like a fly, a bug, going through here are not going to trip it. Even a mouse isn't going to trip it. It needs to be something a little bit larger, starting like a cat, on up to be able to trip this and let you know that there's something there by setting off the alarm. Now the hunting cams, they might be set a little bit lower, say like squirrel size, because they're looking for a game. But again, you're going to rule out the bugs and everything. And another thing to consider, where I think a lot of people don't understand, again, how this is working. Many people use the hunting cams, the trail cams, where they will take a burst of pictures or take a video when the unit detects an infrared heat signature, which means it's detecting movement. Basically, something has moved into the field, and that's how it's detecting that, by the infrared heat signature that shouldn't be there now. When you review those pictures and you see that there are maybe 3 in a row that are empty, there's nothing there, they are your positive pictures. Because now you have photographic proof that the motion sensor was tripped by something that the camera couldn't even pick up, yet it gave off enough of an infrared heat signature that it tripped the motion sensor alarm in it. And that, again, is pretty substantial. I see a lot of people just toss away, though. They see that nothing in the photos, there's nothing to save, they toss them away. When actually the empty photos show you that something invisible to the naked eye and to that camera tripped that motion sensor. And to me, that's something worth saving. Even though you're saving empty photos, you definitely want to make a note of it, because now you know a time. A lot of these read temperature, so that you get a little bit more about the area or the environment when that motion sensor was tripped. So that's useful information that you want to know, and it might be discarded by someone who just simply isn't aware of, how the item works, and again, how, it's applied to ghost hunting. I guess the next category we can go over is recorders. There's digital recorders. Now, when I first started, we used tape recorders. Now, anyone out there still using tape recorders, that's great, because that's fine. They still sell cassette tapes. They're still inexpensive. So you're still doing it old school, that's fine. Make sure, though, that if you're using a tape recorder of some kind, that you're using an external mic on a cable. So that and put the mic a few feet away from the recorder. Because the recorder's internal windings make sounds themselves, and you don't want to, have something that sounds like a cry or a sigh or something like that. That's actually the internal mechanisms of the device itself being picked up by the internal microphone. So whenever we used to use those, we always used external mics simply for that. Now, when you're using the digital voice recorders, you don't have to worry about that. That isn't a problem anymore. They're recording just like recording to a flash drive or, similar to a hard drive. It's putting writing it right to memory. There's no moving parts in there. So using the condenser mics that are built into the recorders is fine. The only time I wind up using external mics is in areas with a lot of echo in them. Areas that have a lot of echo, whether it's just the acoustics of a smaller room or a very large room, say a gymnasium or a church or something like that, where you got a lot of acoustics, the smaller mics will, or the external mics, will actually help reduce that echo. Also, if you're outside and you are in a situation where there's a breeze or some wind when you're recording outside, external mics with windscreens will reduce that hiss and that wind sound that you're going to have constantly over while you're trying to do EVPs. So you'll have less editing to do later on, trying to reduce that sound, that background sound, and remove it. Now, I've used everything from the very first digital recorders that came out to refurbished ones today. I haven't found any difference in any of them, to be honest with you. I'm not one that gets a lot of EVPs, but they all seem to work just about the same for me across the board, from the original ones to the ones that are up there now. Many people are looking for the USB versions of the recorders because the ease of being able to plug and play and it opens up a folder on your computer instantly. The downside of that is many of those, you really have to look into the model you're buying, because a lot of them force you to use the proprietary software that comes with the recorder, and many of those, many of that software make you download the files in WMA format, which unfortunately most of the editing programs that you would use don't read. So now you automatically have to convert it over to an MP3 or a WAV file. So it's adding an extra step in there. Before USB, we still had to hook up 4 digital recorders. We had to still hook up our tape recorders to our computers if we wanted to transfer it over to the computer. There's a very simple way to do that. Most of you already have the equipment to do that. What you need is a patch cable. A patch cable is the same thing that you would use to plug your headphone jack of your MP3 player into like the headphone jack or the mic jack of your computer or your car, for the hook your iPod up into your car. It's the same cable. It's a male end. So what you do is you take the one end of the cable, you put it in the headphone jack of your recorder. You take the other end of the cable and you plug it in the mic jack of your computer. Then you open any program, as long as you have the mic unmuted and have the mic chosen as the recording source. Any program, an Audacity, anything, even Windows has a built-in recorder called Sound Recorder under Tools. Any of them will allow you to, once you press play on the recorder, you'll hear it over your speakers, but you can record it as well. And now you've just transferred your digital recorder audio onto your computer. It's that simple, and it actually is, to me, it's just as quick, or if not quicker, than the USB, especially if you have the kind that converts it to WMA. It saves you a whole step of going back and converting those files back. There is a new piece of EVP equipment out there that's brand new, only a month old. It's called the RT-EVP, the Real-Time EVP Recorder. Now, that piece of equipment, what that allows you to do is something that people have, I guess, have really thought of or dreamed of for a long time, and it comes from the makers of the Mel. So this was specifically, again, designed for paranormal researchers. While it has it's a very, very good audio recorder, a very sensitive mic, and it also allows you to record down into infrasound, down to 15 hertz, which is well below, most recorders are going to stop at 19, because the human ear can't hear below that. But this is going to actually record below that, down to 15, and raise it up so you're able to hear anything that should be recorded down that low. Now, in addition to that, it has a feature of the real-time playback. You pick a time interval from 1 to 60 seconds, and I usually pick 10. So say I'm recording for 10 seconds, maybe I'm just asking questions. At the end of the 10 seconds, my questions and any possible answers are instantly played back over the headphones to me. That is something that it's instantaneous gratification. It's instantaneous whether you've got an answer to a question, so you can follow up with another question to the same spirit. It's almost like being on a phone call. The potential is enormous. While you're hearing the playback, it is still recording. So you can leave it recording, just ambient conversation, or the ambient going on during an investigation as people walk around. A lot of people like to leave the recorders on constantly. And you can set the playback for a longer playback time, a longer delay. But you will hear, at whatever interval, you will hear that past range played back for you. And you will know within it, at the maximum 60 seconds, that some sound heard. And people are picking up amazing things, from gunshots to footsteps to knocks and bangs to voices and answers. It's opening up stuff that people would have never gotten with their regular recorders, or not have gotten or known about until they got home to review their evidence. You are now knowing about this on the spot. And it is probably one of the most expensive pieces of equipment that you will have, but there has been nothing else like it. So it's something you might want to look into. It's called the RT-EVP. It's just a phenomenal tool, and something like probably would have been on our wish list of something we would dream up years ago. And now it's available to researchers, so it's something that you might not want to pass up. I would actually put this probably at the top of the list, since EVPs are probably, to me anyway, more credible evidence than a lot of other things that would count, especially regular photos. So I would put this ahead of even fancy cameras, I would definitely go for this because you're going to get a lot more out of this over a longer period of time. And the cameras wind up are probably a lesser expense, actually, down the road. There's always a few other things that people ask in reference to, like, basic equipment and things like that. People see that either I carry or the store sells multicolor flashlights, and they wonder why. There are certain colors that don't dilate your pupils and don't interfere with your night vision. We're going to be in the dark, and there's already probably going to be cameras flashing as it is, making our night vision, you know, go in and out. So you really don't need bright white light to be introduced or have people walking around with that on. It's just going to take longer for your eyes to adjust, you know, and it's going to wreak havoc on them all night long as you're trying to, like, see as you walk into lighter and darker areas with flashlights. So we use red light. And now with the LED lights, it's even brighter, so it doesn't actually dim the light at all. You can get a very bright red LED light. I use one that has white light, green light, and red light just by the click of a switch. And there's a lot out there that are multicolor or tricolor. That way, you have the white light should you need it in the case of emergency to see something. You know, it could be dangerous or a way out of a place. But on a regular investigation where you don't want to mess up your night vision, the red light's there for you too. So you're killing two birds with one stone. And to me, the less I have to carry and the more things I can do with one piece of equipment, you know, the happier I am, because you already know, those of you out there, you have to basically have three hands to carry everything and use everything. That kind of leads into some of the little things that people don't realize when they're first starting out. For you people that are beginning, one of the most important things you need to remember is you're going to have, the more equipment you buy, you're going to have a way that you can easily access this, as well as protect it. So I see a lot of people that buy equipment cases, and that's great for traveling, you know, to and from an investigation. But on an investigation, you're not going to want to lug that equipment case or even that backpack from floor to floor, from room to room. So what I see a lot of people do is either the carpenter aprons or the waitress aprons that you can get different places. They will use them. You got three pockets. Everything's right at your disposal. You can fill things up. Or the hunting vests or the photographer's vests, something on those lines, that have, like, tons of cameras. I would always use cargo pants or the military-style pants with, you know, the multiple pockets. Anything that could give me an edge to carry more stuff and have it more readily available than digging through a bag or opening a case back up to get it. I'd like to be able to carry a thermometer with me, two EMF meters, along with my camera rig, and, you know, maybe my RT-EVP or something else. All that, I need to be able to have all that stuff at my disposal at any time, because I don't know what event's going to happen that might make me want to use a different piece of equipment. And I don't have time to go digging it out of the case because something's happening right in front of me. So the sooner I can get to it, you know, the better off I am. So put some thought into that. You know, people, I've seen people make some pretty creative stuff up on their own for, you know, whether it's pouches hanging off a belt or a certain jacket you wear or something. You know, be creative, but making sure that you can get the stuff as quickly as possible and carry it safely from room to room as you are on investigation is just as important as protecting it in transit to the investigation. So just another little tip there. Also, radio systems. Those of you who are working in teams that split up, or if you're working with maybe three or four more people where you're going to be on different floors, you really should invest in getting the radios, the FRS radios. They're the walkie-talkies. You see them in almost every kind of retail store carries them. Cobra is a big brand name, and it enables you to, it's more for safety than anything else. Should something happen where you need help instantly, you're able to contact someone on a different floor. Should they need to be made aware of something quickly, and a yell isn't going to work or it's not the right place for that, the walkie-talkie really is going to come in handy. And it goes in line with the flashlight and the belt to carry the equipment. Something that's a basic necessity. If you're doing, you know, more than two people, really, and there's a chance that you might even be in other rooms, it really pays to have them, because the time that you need them and you don't have it, you know, you're going to be kicking yourself if something serious happens. And some, it could be something as minor as just, you know, losing somebody in the cemetery where they get lost in a large cemetery and you don't know what happened to them. This is speaking from experience, where the two ladies walked away, and actually they did have radios, but the radios, the batteries died in them, and they weren't aware of it. But, you know, so it's just like not having them. But they went off down a trail in a wooded cemetery, and we didn't know where they were. And in a dark cemetery, especially in a wooded area, they could have been laying between stones, and it would have taken hours to find them. So, you know, had they had working radios, we could have easily known where they were. They could have easily let us know where they were going. You know, it really pays, because that way you know when to start to panic and when to, you know, not to have to worry, because you're going to be able to constantly communicate with someone. Those of you, again, going out in cemeteries, keep in mind that sometimes you might come across people that, you know, maybe spend more time in the cemeteries than you do, or live there, anything like that, so, or just taking advantage of the dark. So you can run into some unsavory characters depending on the area that you're at. Some of you also have to worry about wildlife. I know some of our people that live up in the north end of New Jersey, anyway, that I know when we had a north team for SJGR, when we used to split it up by region, they actually had to carry mace when they were out on investigations, just to keep, in case the bears came, just to keep them away and it spread downwind. So a radio letting people know, hey, there's a bear headed your way, you know, would probably be greatly appreciated in the long run. So I hope you found some of these things helpful. Like I said, I crunched in some of the basic equipment in a very short period of time. So if you have any questions, or I can go over anything with you, or, you know, me or anyone else from the Shadowlands or SJGR or the Ghost Hunter Store, just, you know, give us a holler at the different venues, and we'll be happy to help you out, answer any questions. Would I have people come into the store, you know, and they ask me what I recommend? I'll tell them what I recommend, but I'll show them all the different ones, explain the features, and let them see what they do. You know, because everyone's going to have their own personal preference. What worked for me might not be the best choice for you, and you're going to have to decide that by, you know, getting to see some hands-on stuff. So if you're a new person in the field, you know, keep in mind probably less is more in the very beginning, and then wait till you can get to see some other people's equipment, or get to take a class, or see some of the other stuff in action before maybe you put a large investment out there anyway. Unless you're really sure that this is something you're going to want to do, and down the road you can never have too much, because there's always an instance where you're going to need that extra equipment. I usually carry, you know, a few, two or three cases with me of equipment, my personal equipment. I don't obviously use all that on an investigation, but all my tools are available to me should I need something specialized for that investigation. And that's, yeah, I feel good knowing that I have the ability to switch things up and use something that I may not use all the time if the case calls for it. So as the more you get involved with that, you'll find that that's a nice little thing to be able to do. All right, everybody, we are working hard on getting the show to be a weekly show on Fridays. Right now we're still bi-weekly, so keep sending in your questions. If you have suggestions for guests, send them into us. Any kind of, you know, criticisms or comments, shoot them on out. You can reach us on Facebook, on the websites, wherever you want to get a hold of us. Just let us know what you think, and if you have any topics you want us to cover, anything like that, it's great to hear. And the more input we get from you guys, the easier the transition will be to go from bi-weekly to every week. And we will be doing that eventually, but the sooner the better. All right, everyone, take care, and we'll see you in 2 weeks.